Exploit Roundtable.
Bonus episode.
Hello and welcome to a year-end bonus episode of Reality Exploit Roundtable. My name is Voodoo and I'm joined today by Wise Guy, Smuggler, and Plato from the regular Roundtable. We're going to shake things up a bit today. Instead of our usual four topics, we're going to do some end-of-year cleaning up by taking a bunch of topics that we just haven't gotten around to on regular Roundtable episodes. While we're doing that, we thought it'd be a good time to introduce our digital production assistant. As time's gone on, we've tried to automate more and more of the Roundtable production, and we've dubbed the collection of scripts and programs that we use Taboo. So the first thing we're going to change going forward is a timer on topics to try and keep us on schedule so that we can get consistent episode lengths. Why don't you tell us about that timer, Taboo?
When the moderator asks the first question, a timer will start. When half of the time allotted for that topic has elapsed, you will hear this tone. When the entire time has elapsed, you will hear this.
Yeah, and we're not rule followers, so God knows if we'll even pay attention to that, but that sounds good. All right, Taboo, you might as well take the moderator role today if you want. Take it away.
Okay, let's start with some recaps. Plato, in episode 14 you talked about free cities in Honduras, but the Supreme Court ruled them unconstitutional.
Yep, that's right. However, the thing is that in Honduras, the core structure in the government is kind of skewed up. It's unclear whether this project is going to go on or not, and at least it's raised the discussion of creating territorial zones that are autonomous and have their own legal structures and stuff. I do encourage you guys to go and look at our show notes in episode 14 and read through the thread of comments on one of the original blog posts, because there's a lot of great discussion in there from residents and people in the government, and it's worth checking out.
I don't understand how they made this, said this was unconstitutional. This was done as a constitutional amendment in the first place. So, obviously I don't understand the legal system in Honduras, but if you make a constitutional amendment, doesn't that by definition?
I think they never did. I think they wrote the amendment and somebody prematurely said, hey, we're amending it. It's going to be good. And then they didn't pass the amendment. I think that's what happened.
Interesting. I was under the impression that it had already passed as a constitutional amendment, and that then the Supreme Court came back and said, nope, it's not constitutional, which sounded like a break of tautology to me or something.
Well, I guess we are crap at researching our topics. Sorry, audience.
Well, the thing is that essentially the Constitutional Court can test if an amendment will be in the line and in the spirit of the rest of the Constitution. So there are higher parts of the Constitution and lower parts of the Constitution.
Perfect. Thanks, Smuggler.
Smuggler, despite our advice to students in Houston to hack their school ID, one student got suspended for refusing to wear it. What do you have to say to the rest of the students?
That they are cowards, and that they're not participating in that protest is horrific. I mean, please, you're turned into an asset, just numbered and treated like anything. I mean, please, stand up against it and join the ranks of Andrea and whoever is with her, and simply stop obeying those control freaks.
Yeah, I'd go back to what we originally said is, there's a lot of games to be played with these RFID chips, and it's kind of disappointing that I'm not hearing any games being played with them already.
Yeah, that's truly sad. I mean, it seems that they're just going along, and that is really bad.
Well, isn't that the whole point of school?
Yeah, but change that. Listen to Reality Exploit Roundtable. We give good advice for protest, and just follow us.
Yeah, but we're degenerates.
Well, not the worst people on the planet, I guess. We're not making people wear RFID chips, do we?
Wise guy?
Yeah, we are.
Well, the value in RFID chips is that they're very, very good at helping track things that move. Unfortunately, then people figured out that, hey, they're also good at tracking the things that make things move, which would be people, and that's where the problem is to me.
Well, I think that something similar is happening in the banking industry, where the transactions using RFID and now near-field communications in the PIN cards are definitely being used to go well beyond anything that's needed to prevent fraud, but actually providing databases about what people are doing with their money and where, you know, and making any kind of privacy more and more difficult.
But Weisgott, you're blowing their cover. That is the story behind it. Of course, it's not about fraud or making us safe. Of course, it is about tracking us and controlling us, nothing else.
Absolutely.
Voodoo, you have said that dogs are just dowsing rods for probable cause. But some UC Santa Barbara researchers are doing something novel in mechanical explosives detection. Take a listen.
Dogs are the gold standard for explosives detection as well as detection of vapors from illicit substances. And what we're able to do is develop a machine based upon microfluidics and nanotechnology that can sense with the same quality and performance that a dog, and in some instances even better than a dog.
It's better than dogs at explosives detection. So doesn't that sound better to you?
Yeah, not so much. It's funny that their gold standard for explosive detection has not been subjected to a double-blind trial. These are just dowsing rods. So far, any track record that I've seen of a sniffing dog has been just barely better than chance. So yes, they have better noses than humans, but you know, they're not superhuman. They're not some sort of mythical creature that can sniff out things that these people aren't saying. And if these mechanical chips are as good as and maybe sometimes better than dogs, well, then they need to be subjected to double-blind trials too. But having said all that, it's they're doing something novel here, which is, you know, the air that they're passing through these little tubes, they're concentrating on the sides of these tubes less than the width of a human hair, and then sampling that, which, you know, might end up with some good results. But then they need to show that in between samples that they're sufficiently clearing out those channels and that they're not getting residue in that. And I didn't see anything about that from these researchers.
I wonder how well they can handle multiple combined smells, and does that screw up the test?
Well, the gold standard for sniffing things out is, of course, the bee, the common honeybee, which is much better and less distracted than dogs are. But what this reminds me of is a project that the Stasi had, the East German intelligence service. And what they did, they collected smell samples of people so they could track and find those people later. So I wonder when we will have police running around and tracking people by their smell.
I've got a smell they can track.
Wise guy, in a previous episode we talked about ride-sharing applications like Lyft and Sidecar. Did you hear about Uber being accused of price gouging after Hurricane Sandy?
Well, yes. The taxi business is the typical rent-seeking guild. They pitch themselves as good for the public, but nothing can be further from the truth. As Alan Greenspan once remarked, regulation favors the regulated. By using taxi commissions and other regulators, taxi operators have prevented any meaningful competition in their industry from the beginning. And by the way, I'd like to say that I knew this for a long time because my grandfather was a taxi driver. Uber should not have backed down during Sandy. Sure, they might have gotten a black eye in the press, but their economics was right on, and it was certainly as it certainly was, and their ability to supply cars would have made a double impact on consumers. Not only would their system work, but they'd show that their economics operated behind the scenes to make it work. So Uber-type services are great opportunities for the longtime unemployed who still have good credit and are judgment-proof. Just rent the vehicles from an agency like Hertz and Dollar. Cars are near new, mileage is typically unlimited, and you can get good weekly and weekend rates. If you have a platinum card, they provide insurance for free, though I'm not sure if the card or rental insurance will cover for-hire situations. But if not, it's a great opportunity for insurers. The insurance risk is mainly to the passenger, as the driver is judgment proof. They have little fear in a civil lawsuit.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting. It was they were actually showing how by raising the rates right after Hurricane Sandy, they were actually bringing cars into places where people needed transportation. And yet, you know, they get accused of price gouging. So they said, okay, fine, well, we won't raise the rates. And then the cars disappeared. So, I mean, it was proof positive there of the economics.
This is why there's farm supports in most countries, most notably in the European Union, because if people are exposed to the free market, they get really upset when they have to pay what the going cost and rate should be with a reasonable profit margin by the people in that business. So instead, the governments tax the people, steal their money, pay it to the people who are having these price supports, and then the people can buy the product like milk, for example, or cheese at some unrealistically low price and feel that everything is working. Maybe the taxi driver organizations should do the same thing and go to the government and get paid by them. Then they could lower the taxi rates and people would think things are great.
I think I'm getting the hang of this. Let's move on to
drone warfare.
Smuggler. In September, US media placed posters depicting the NYPD shooting at kids from drones at bus stops. Here's why.
The meaning of the drone campaign? Well, for me, it's really about creating a conversation. We've obviously seen a little bit of press in the last year due to street signs that I was involved with about the possibility of the NYPD authorizing drones to fly in the skies domestically. And I don't think the conversation has reached a mainstream level where we are like talking about this at the dinner table and whether we want this to take place. We have to remember that these are devices that right now internationally are being used to kill people. They're armed, they shoot missiles. We're fighting an illegal war in Pakistan and nobody seems to want to talk about what we're bombing people left and right. I think we should be talking about whether that's technology we want to bring to this country.
Apparently the NYPD didn't want the conversation. In November, they arrested Desim and charged him with 56 counts of possessing a forged instrument and possession of an unloaded 22. Why are they so afraid of a conversation?
Well, I don't think that they're afraid of the conversation. The only thing they're really pissed off with is the protocol of conversation. Because people, listen, the way the government wants to convert with you, to talk with you, is they say something, you listen.
Yeah, very true. This was, but they're just, you know, proving his point about the overhanded or overreaching tactics of the NYPD when they arrest him for making a political point like this.
Yeah, but he wasn't licensed to make any point.
Plato, according to an AP poll, only 36% of Americans surveyed are opposed or strongly opposed to police use of unmanned drones. Why is this number so low?
Two possible reasons. One is that 64% of Americans thinks it's a great idea. Another likely one is that the poll methodology is producing a low number. I think it depends a lot on who you ask. Certainly, you know, all of us panelists are pretty concerned about putting drones in our skies. I can't really add much to what Esom said in our last answer because this is some dangerous technology, powerful technology, and it's really easy to go wrong with it. And, you know, plus the majority of the media that gets out in America is not showing, you know, drone strikes in Pakistan. It is a forbidden topic.
Well, I think that most people are supporting these things because they don't think that it's going to affect their lives in any negative way. In the same way that people don't think that their mobile communications, which is tracking them all the time and all of the breadcrumbs that they're leaving about their life activities, aren't going to somehow come back, like, for instance, in a divorce or some other situation and screw them big time. But they don't think about it.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Right, and there are lots of people that actually believe in the government system, the legal system, to actually work and do what's good. And So for drones or for Trojans or whatever, it's all the same. They say, you know what? We have a system. We have separation of powers. This will work. It won't be that bad. So they trust the system and the technology will screw them.
Yeah. And by the time the system evolves into something ridiculous, it's damn near impossible to get rid of it.
Well, the other thing is that, of course, the people evolve into something ridiculous at the same time.
And I'd go back to what Smuggler said just in episode 15, that drones are sexy. And if the police can make a good case, you know, putting more helicopters in the sky and putting police on the streets are sexy, too. And they get people to vote for those all the time. They'll vote for, you know, tax increases to pay for drones, too.
Voodoo. After the U.S. election, it came out that Obama was worried about entrusting Mitt Romney with a kill list. Why doesn't Obama trust democracy?
I'd say he doesn't trust democracy for the same reason none of the rest of us should trust democracy. Here, this is a question that should be out of bounds of a democracy. You don't ask, should a president be entrusted with a kill list? You ask, on how in you know, anything, the name of anything that's holy, does anyone end up with a kill list? It just proved that democracy fails if you can't restrain the democracy from and asking questions like that, as far as I'm concerned.
I think it actually shows that democracy has succeeded. Democracy is basically the ability for the majority to decide what rights anyone should have and what's legal, whether or not there's any natural law behind it. So it's okay if it's for people to entrust powers that they don't have, such as the ability to imprison someone privately or to murder someone. It's okay when enough people vote something that someone else can do it. It's okay?
Yeah, I guess by the logic of democracy, kill lists are a good thing.
Well, whenever you ask someone, they say democracy is such a great thing, and you say, well, okay, so what if the majority votes to kill you? You know, and they shut right down. Well, no, that would never happen. Well, in this case, that's exactly what's happening. Of course, you know, now that Obama is reelected, he's slowing down on the, you know, the administration slowing down on making these rules for how they can use a kill list, because, you know, like Eric Holder says, you're just guaranteed due process by the Constitution, and we've determined that due process is Obama figuring out whether you should die or not.
I actually think that it's not so much about Obama not trusting Romney. I think the point behind it is really that Obama wanted to show that he's a considerate person that works according to some kind of system that there is in America, and that he's not arbitrarily killing people, but that he has some kind of rule for it. And I think he just wanted to demonstrate that so that he wouldn't be indicted afterwards if he lost the election.
That could be, but that would have been a point to make before the election, not after the election.
Well, true.
Well, there's still time to indict him.
All right. Time for some of the econ and finance stories we just didn't get to. Plato. A study by Dorit Ron and Ajish Amir found that 78% of bitcoins remained under the control of the persons who mined them. What will happen to the bitcoin economy when those coins are unleashed?
Well, there will be more bitcoin circulating. And it'll be basically a Bitcoin quantitative easing. I mean, you know, not that there's some guy in the middle who's saying release the Bitcoins, but some participant in the economy is saying, you know what, I want to spend these now, I want to cash out. And he dumps, you know, 100,000 Bitcoins, or, you know, in the case of the biggest accounts, like a million Bitcoins into the economy. And there's going to be more money chasing the same amount of products, which is likely to drive prices down. At least at first, and that includes the cost of each Bitcoin, and that's likely to get more people to start participating, because if they see cheap Bitcoins, they might get scared and say, oh shit, Bitcoin's failing, or they might say, oh nice, cheap Bitcoins, I can invest more. So, you know, I don't know what'll happen, but we'll see.
It really depends on what economic theory you're following. I mean, if you're a good old Keynesian or monetarist, this will be awesomely good for the Bitcoin economy. I mean, just print more money, higher liquidity, everything is good, we'll all be rich. Or, as I believe, it will just, you know, fix the price of Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody knows, at least now after that paper's been published, everybody knows that those Bitcoins are sitting there and they could be unleashed at any time. I'm sure that's priced in.
Well, I doubt it.
Yeah, likely.
No, most markets are very poor about pricing in risk. I mean, just before the beginning of World War I, UK bonds were trading at premiums that indicated that there was no risk for war.
You know, I got to throw in one tiny stat I saw on Zero Hedge, and that's simply that out of the $600 trillion worth of derivatives that are owned by like the big players in the derivative markets, there's only $600 billion of collateral banking all those debts, and they're all bets in this giant mesh against each other. So if AIG fails again and people can't pay off the collateral on these debts, it's going to end up in a giant chain where nobody gets their money from all these derivatives. So I think it's, it kind of has a parallel with the Bitcoins because it's a bunch of wealth that's stored in this little segment of the economy that might disappear.
They can get a Bitcoin bailout.
Yes, a financial circle jerk.
Voodoo. Among the stupid ideas for not falling off or cushioning the fiscal cliff is a proposal to mint $1 trillion platinum coins. If you are going to salvage change from your couch, it might as well be worth your while, right?
Yeah, I don't know why they're going to stop at trillion-dollar coins. I would go ahead and make it even quadrillion, and then we can all take the next 200 years off or something. It's, you know, it's just a silly proposal, just as Smuggler was just saying with the Keynesian utopia. Monetarists are just as capable of this, and if you just print enough money, you can solve any problem. And that's all this is. It's just somebody spitballing, saying, oh, you know, we could pay it off with two... Congress decides how much coins are worth, they could just pay off all the debt, and of course it's not going to work.
Actually, when I read this the first time, I thought to myself, hey, this shouldn't be in the Washington Post. This is a release by the Comedy Central.
Yeah, that's about right.
Wise guy. Mexico has banned large cash transactions, including limiting currency exchange to $1,500 per month. Have similar bans on the use of cash produced any results, or is this just a continuation of the war on anonymity?
That was for a wise guy.
Oh, sorry. Clearly it's all about monitoring financial transactions and people's movements. There's no doubt that the limitation of financial transactions to a certain amount doesn't work, because it just goes into the underground economy. In the same way the war on drugs has failed to end drug trade, in fact, quite the contrary, there's no doubt that people will decide, hey, this is bullshit, and I'm going to do with my money whatever I want.
Well, the other point is not just the war against anonymity, but it's actually forcing people to use the systems that are controlled by the state, so that the state can manipulate what you're doing in those systems. So it's not just about gathering more information; it's also about manipulating how people act. People are forced into using the banking system, into using official systems. And whenever they're all in there, then you can use those systems to apply whatever pressure you want to the population.
I think also that those systems have a large enough market share, mostly by denying competition, that it gives them some advantages in the marketplace that wouldn't exist if people had the options to choose alternate currencies.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's the point of having a new method of enforcement. I mean, the term for that is soft tyranny, as I recall correctly, And that is, you want people to be nudged into the one